This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Louie Cronin about her new book called Everyone Loves You Back. It's a novel. It's set in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I presume you live. Is that correct, Louie?
I actually don't live there anymore because I was priced out. So I moved out when I bought a condo because I couldn't afford to stay. But I still live in Boston.
And in fact, the book is, to a great extent, because it's set in this changing social milieu, and I guess that's the background. It's been part of your experience being in Boston of, let's call it social change in neighborhoods. This novel is about, I'm very careful. We don't want to give away the whole story so people can read it for themselves. But we can talk about the backdrop and the setting and the characters. So your main character is this guy, Bob, who's his family's been in Cambridge for a couple of generations, and he's in his 40s. It's set, I take it that it's set, pretty recently in this environment.
Yeah, I was thinking of like late 90s.
Okay,
I said it, yes.
So, but the social tensions that existed then are probably even more exacerbated today. They feel familiar, I don't know Boston and Cambridge that well, but it's certainly something that we're aware of that, maybe it's happening in a really big way in San Francisco, and it's certainly happened in New York in various neighborhoods where people who have been there a long time are being supplanted by newer people with lots more money, let's say, maybe of a different social class or different kind of value systems. And that creates, it's good tension for fiction, I think.
Right. Exactly. It's inevitable, the tension, because people have so much more money than the newcomers have so much more money.
What's
funny is that I'm kind of, I lived in Cambridge and I was, pretty much priced out of Cambridge. I couldn't afford to live there anymore. And I moved to Jamaica Plain, which is another part of Boston, not really nice part of Boston, less expensive. And for a while, I felt like the interloper. I felt like the person who came in and paid top dollar for the condo, And now the same thing is happening here where I live. Like, I couldn't afford to buy another condo here where I live because the same thing has happened in this part of town, too.
And one of the things that you, you describe in the book, in the course of the story, and the story is not literally all about the events that take place between Bob and some of his neighbors, but that's, it's kind of an ongoing undercurrent of his life while other things are happening that the book is really about. And I guess what I wanted to ask about that is that, do you see that happening all over Boston, this sort of tension between people who were there and who feel that they're the neighborhoods that they knew and that they were part of are being changed? And, is there this sort of war between people in the, like neighbors kind of literally fighting over space and trees and, the way things should look? And, is that really going on? Is that something you've experienced yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I totally experienced it when I lived in Cambridge. And I lived in Cambridge. I was born there. I grew up there. And then I came back there as an adult and lived there for like 19 years, I think. So I totally experienced it there. Like, growing up, Cambridge was always a real mix of people from Harvard and professional people and students, but also very working class people. And over the years, the working class people just can't afford it. They just, even neighborhoods, it's funny, like even neighborhoods that my mom remembers as being, oh, that wasn't that nice, are completely beautiful and gentrified now and, you know, completely, you know, actually heavenly and completely renovated. And it's happening. It's happening all over Boston, and I'm sure other cities too. Like every neighborhood in Boston, that's happening too. And I mean, now I'll give you an example. Next door to where I live, they sold the house, knocked it down. For the couple who lived there had lived there since, you know, the 70s. They, you know, bought the house, knocked it down, tore it down, and put in three townhouses, each of which went for almost $1 million.
That's amazing. Well, you know, it reminds me of what happened in suburbia in America, you know, in the 50s and 60s, and later, and it's still ongoing, this idea that, you know, that land was farmland, it was working land, or it was just places where people lived who were not well-to-do. And as the cities kind of, you know, with the population boom of the 50s and 60s, everyone went to the suburbs, and all of those places were changed radically. I read a book years ago, and I think it was called Every Place You Love Is Gone. And it was this kind of, it was a memoir, a nonfiction memoir about the woman who wrote it had grown up in, you know, a particular place in Ohio, and it was just completely changed. And then she found herself being part of the urban, you know, the gentrification of Hoboken in New Jersey, you know, where she moved there, and then 20 years later moved back, and it was kind of unidentifiable. You know, it change was so rapid in so many places. And I think it's now kind of come back to the cities as the, you know, as the kind of second wave of population growth. I mean, it's funny for us to be talking about this in a way, because you've written a novel and we're talking about a, you know, a social phenomenon, but.
Right. Exactly. Well, I mean, and I think that's what inspired me to write the novel, was just sitting there and watching the world transform around me. You know, it was really the inspiration. So, and really, like, the voice of the novel came to me by sitting there watching everything happen around my apartment. So,
well, and this is your first novel, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it is.
But you've been writing for a while.
Yeah, I've been writing for a really long time. And before that, I wrote short stories. And I had never attempted a novel before. So this one, somebody suggested, why don't you try to put a story that had, you know, you'd started but never finished, see if that could become a novel. And that's what I did. And I found out I totally loved writing a novel.
What was it that you loved about it?
You know, I think I liked being able to keep on going and to write longer. I think over the years, my short stories got longer and longer. And I think I was feeling the pressure with my short stories to keep them shorter. So I really liked being able to just expand a bit. And I guess the other thing is just keep on going off on different things that interested me. So, and then the other thing is sort of just spending that much time with the characters was a totally different experience. It was, you know, like really a fun experience, sort of like reading a long novel is a fun experience because you're with them for so long. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
No, it's interesting to think about, you know, just how, I've talked to a lot of novelists about, you know, living with their characters, and it's always interesting because the characters become so much a part of the writer's life, you know, because you're with them for so long and you know them so well. And of course, in this case, you wrote a main character who's a guy and you're a woman. So that makes it interesting too. You know, trying to, maybe it makes, is it, do you think it's easier in some ways to express yourself through this indirect form of the character of a different gender?
That's a very good question. You know, it was definitely not easy at times. At times, I really felt like I was, you know, struggling to think, like, what would a man see here? What would a man say here? And, you know, I actually read this book chapter by chapter to my writing group. And at times they would stop me and say, oh, a man wouldn't say that. Or a man does not notice another man's clothes. You know, like that, I had this whole, you know, thing where Bob was describing what the other guy had on and they said, stop, no, you know. But I mean, it's sort of an interesting question because it's like, it does limit you. Like, it limited me from, you know, it did set me a task and set parameters I had to stick to because it wasn't me. It couldn't, you know, it was somebody outside of me. So in that way, I think, you know, it's often good to have some sort of limit on you. And it did do that, but it was also, it was a challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think it would maybe, I don't know, it's hard, impossible to generalize, but it seems like it would be a difficult thing to do for anyone, you know, to write from this experience that is completely unlike your own. I mean, ultimately that, you know, we can't really know what the other, you know, somebody's life is like if we are not, if we don't ever experience it directly, but then you can't say that no one has the ability to imagine something else. You know, otherwise there is no imagination.
Right, right. Exactly. And I think, you know, I have three brothers, so I definitely have, you know, I grew up surrounded by men. So I felt like if I were writing a man who was really different than me, that would have been even harder. Like if it was a man who was interested in things that I don't get at all, like sports and hunting and, I don't know, cars. It would have been much harder for me.
Well, it's interesting you should mention cars because we have to, you know, you spent years working for Car Talk. So now you're telling me you're not interested in cars at all and you spent all those years with the car guys?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you know, the truth of the matter is that they're not that interested in cars. I mean, they're kind of interested in everything, you know.
Well, that's
they're
true. Like that's true. No, they're more right. They were the most. They were well. That's what made the show so interesting. Is that the cars were the entry point into their interest in human beings and technology and life in general.
Exactly.
I think otherwise, it wouldn't have been as it wouldn't have touched so many people. You know, I think clearly, just talking car talk stuff. You know about the technology of cars and how they work. That's why car magazines have the audiences that they do, as opposed to right. Car Talk, which had a much bigger audience.
But exactly.
But it's funny that you, you know, you were not interested in cars.
Right. Well, I remember when I first started there, and one of my bosses said to me, "Oh, and you know, you got to learn something about cars, okay?" So, by the time I left there, I could misdiagnose car problems, you know. I knew enough about, you know, common car problems and common sounds and, you know, I kind of knew how hard a problem it was, you know. So I knew the lingo.
Right. So you could sort of fake it, you know, in that way.
Exactly. I could fake it.
Well, so what was I going to ask you about that? There was, you know, I didn't want to really talk about that because we wanted to talk about this book, but did, well, I know, because you're living in Cambridge, in Boston, you grew up there. Was that a kind of place where you didn't need to have a car when you were a kid? Did you grow up not driving?
No, I grew up with a car, and I definitely, we didn't live in as sort of an urban a part of Cambridge as there is. You know, I didn't grow up in as urban an area, and we always had a car. And so we always had a car, but we also, you know, always took public transportation because, you know, there are parts of Boston you just can't get to with a car. Or if you have a car, you just, you know, pay $28, put it away somewhere. So I grew up with a car, and I always had cars, and I always drove, and but actually right before, I hadn't had a car for years and years and years because I lived in New York. And then when I first moved back to Boston, I didn't have a car probably for the first, 10 years or so. So.
Well, cars don't play as big a role in a city, I think, most of the time.
Exactly.
Especially in a place, exactly, you know, where parking is a problem, so you don't necessarily want to have to deal with it all the time. So they're not, you know, it wasn't a big part of your book, you know, the car thing.
No.
Well, by the time you were finished writing this book with these characters, I would assume, I take it that you kind of felt like they were your, you know, they're your people, and it felt like they were people that you liked and kind of drew. I mean, because you've worked in radio, and all the characters in the book work in radio, that they sort of, they also come from the older era. You know, they kind of represent, radio as it used to be, let's say.
Yes.
You know, the kind of last era of personal involvement where it wasn't so much programmed. You know, these are like late night, as you have them, late night jazz people who are facing the changes in the record business in the same way that they're, you know, Bob, your main character, is facing social change in his neighborhood. All of the people in the station are facing this challenge of change in their industry.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I think for me, it's just, that's been my experience of life, you know? I mean, it's like radio was always changing. You always felt like you were just about to get thrown out of your job, or, you know, you were just at the tail end of something, and something new was coming in, and you might be pushed out the door. You always felt that in radio. And especially in the 90s, there was a big change where, like, they got rid of music and everything seemed to go for news and talk radio and stuff. So that was a big change, which I went through several times. Like, I swear I went through it at several different jobs, the similar kind of change. So, to me, yeah, they were sort of a piece. Bob's experience in Cambridge and his neighborhood and his experience at work are all part of the same piece of sort of the world changing around you and you're not necessarily welcoming it.
No, I think it's clear your sympathies are on the side of the people who are being disrupted, you know, as on a human level, you know, that because I think a lot of these things especially in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot of media talk about disruption, you know, and it was kind of accepted as the way things are and actually thought of as a good thing. Disrupting the old makes way for the new, and, you know, technology makes for all these changes. And I think there was a tendency, and I think maybe we'll look back on this culturally and have some, you know, maybe there will be more questioning of the all the benefits of the supposed benefits of those changes. You know, they may be less clear, and I think we feel that today. I think that's in the political air as well, that a lot of what you see as tension in society is coming from the effects of all that change. Because it affects real human beings, and change may be for the better on some meta level, but on the human level, it's not always so easy.
Right, exactly. I remember once going to hearing a consultant who had come in to talk to the radio station about change, and I just sat there thinking, change can be good and bad. It's not necessarily good. I mean, it was all about embracing change and, embracing the next wave and stuff. I even worked on this campaign once, and it was all about employees having to jump over each new incoming wave, and embrace it, but I always thought to myself, that's nonsense. I mean, change is not inherently good or bad,
Well, I think that's one of the scenes in your book, with the consultant who comes in, you definitely were writing about that with a kind of critical eye, let's put it.
Yeah.
Well, and it's probably something that a lot of people in almost every, any realm of life, any business, any place you've ever been in the last 20 or 30 years, you've come across some of these consultant people and their language and tools.
Exactly. I was just hearing an interview about that movie, Up in the Air. Clooney is the guy who lays people off and, uses all that language about change and everything. And, people, it's kind of amazing how much we bought of all that, I think because, this world, this culture is such a youth culture. It's such a culture of new is good and young is better than old. And, you got to stay current, that it makes you're sort of predisposed to say, I want to be on the side of change. And, I want to be on the side of all the new things that are coming. So, well,
yeah, I think what you just touched on is something that most of us, when growing up, were kind of sold on the idea that new is good. That the new is better than the old. The new will do more things. It's shinier and faster, better, whatever it may be. And so there's all of those years of absorbing that message. So when the new comes along, you do embrace it. You've been sold. And so then the question is that really true? And it may be true sometimes, as you were indicating, change is not inherently bad or good. Some changes are probably good and other changes are probably not so good. But it's hard for us to distinguish. And we don't have necessarily the analytical tools, especially when you're in your microcosm. Things look differently than they do, from another perspective. And you don't necessarily know whether things are good or bad. You don't have all the information.
Right, exactly. And you don't have always equal power, I mean, it's like, my feeling is the more power you have, the more likely the change is going to go in your favor.
Right, or that you can stop the change that shouldn't be happening because you have more power to deal with it. I mean, that's, the imbalance of power is, sometimes in information. Those who have more information have more power in some cases. Of course, we're off the topic of your book. But,
we're off, yes. No, I know.
But still, yeah. I think what that tells us is that your book has a lot going on. And there, I do think that there is a lot of, sort of social observation in this novel that comes through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I think so too. I think that the impetus to do it, and And I'm glad it comes through. And even though it's like, I think I can't help but sort of look for the absurdity and humor in these situations too. So I hope that comes through too. Oh,
well, the humor definitely did. And certainly the absurdity in a lot of, in some of those moments, you know, particularly in the, you know, some of the start and stop relationships and the, in Bob, in particular, Bob's, you know, relationships with the neighbors. And there was quite a bit of humor and absurdity in the, in some of those.
Right.
I, you know, I don't want to give those away, but I particularly, I think I like the proto Zen guy next door. I thought that was,
oh, yes.
You know, you got him pretty well. So,
right.
So, yeah. So I know it's, since this book is, you know, very new, it's probably, you know, premature to ask, but are you working on another novel?
Oh, I am. Yes. I've been working on another novel. I've about 100 pages of another novel written. And, so I am working on another one. It was hard to get going on another one when I finished this, but I eventually settled in to something.
Well, that's good. Is it different, very different, or?
I would say it's different in that it doesn't have the incredibly close perspective that this one has of the main character. So this one, it's really Bob Boland's in every scene, and he's really the heart and soul of the novel. The new novel I'm doing is written in several different perspectives, so it's different than in that way. And it just sort of happened, like I think, you know, the way a lot of writing does, where you don't plan it, but it just comes out that way. It just seems to happen that way, that the story wants to be told in different voices, and, you know. So it's different in that sense, but it's also another workplace novel, and hopefully a little bit like critical and thoughtful about the workplace too.
Well, I think that's good. I think, you know, workplace does lend itself to fiction. Lots of stories, lots of tensions, shall we say.
Yes.
So that,
right.
But I don't think it's not a territory that's been done to death. So there's a lot of room for you there.
Yeah, I think so too. I remember when I was in grad school, I had a teacher who was like, why is anybody writing about work? You know, we spend so much of our days there, this is another workplace novel. So,
well, I will look forward to that one because I really liked your first book. So I'm hoping to read your next one.
Oh, good. Great.
Well, thank you so much, Louie, for talking to me about your book. I really enjoyed doing this.
Thank you.
And it was
it really is
a really wonderful book. So I hope that some of my listeners will discover it. This has been Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Louie Cronin about Everyone Loves You Back. It's her first novel. And it takes place in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but you don't have to have lived there or know it to enjoy it. Thanks, Louie.
Thanks a lot.